36. S of the present administration. Read, the Duke of Wellington holds the brains of the present administration. For, Colonel Sithorpe said he despised the man who suffered himself be made the tool of a party. Read, the fool of a party. The physiology of the London medical student, our lively neighbors on the opposite side of the Pont de Calais as they are pleased, in a spirit of patriotic appropriation, to translate the Straits of Dover, have lately shot off the flight of small literary rockets about Paris, which had exploded joyously in every direction, producing all sorts of fun and merriment. Termed L's Physiologies a series of graphic sketches, embodying various everyday types of characters moving in the French capital. In the same spirit, we beg to bring forward the following papers, with the hope that they will meet with an equally favorable reception. 1. The Introductory Discourse. We are about to discuss a subject as critical and important to take up as the abdominal aorta, for should we offend the class we are about to portray, there are 1,500 medical students, arrived this week in London, ripe and ready to avenge themselves upon our devoted cranium, which, although hardened throughout its ligneous formation by many blows, would not be proof against their united efforts, and we scarcely know how or where to begin. The instincts and different phases, under which this interesting race appears, are so numerous, that far from complaining of the paucity of materials we have to work upon, we are overwhelmed by mental suggestions, and rapidly dissolving views, of the various classes from Guy's to the London University, from St. George's to the London Hospital, perpetually crowding upon our brains if we have any, and rendering our ideas as completely muddled as those of a new man who has, for the first week of October, attended every single lecture in the day, from the commencement of chemistry, at 9 in the morning, to the close of surgery, at 8 in the evening. Lecture, auspicious word, we had a beginning prompted by the mere sound. We will address you, medical students, according to the style you are most accustomed to. Gentlemen, your attention is to be this morning directed to an important part of your course on physiology, which your various professors, at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, will separately tell you is derived from 2 Greek words, so that we have no occasion to explain its meaning at present. Magendie, Mueller, Mayo, Millingen, and various other ums, have written works upon physiology, affecting the human race generally. You are now requested to listen to the demonstration of one species in particular, the medical student of London. Lay aside your deeper studies, then, and turn for a while to our lighter sketches. Forget the globules of the blood in the contemplation of red billiard balls. Supplant the tunica arachnoidea of the brain by a gossamer hepariti, mucosium of the skin by a pea jacket, the vital fluid by a pot of half and half. Call into play the flexor muscles of your arms with boxing gloves and single sticks. Examine the secreting glands in the shape of kidneys and sweetbreads. Demonstrate other theories connected with the human economy in an equally analogous and pleasant manner. Lay aside your Krebselsus and Stagall's manual for our own more enticing pages, and find your various habits therein reflected upon paper, with a truth to nature only exceeded by the artificial man of the same material in the Museum of King's College. Assume for a time all this joyousness. Punch has entered as a pupil at a medical school he is not at liberty to say which, on purpose to note your propensities, and requests you for a short period to look upon him as one of your own lot. His course will commence next week, and the new man will be the subject. Michaelmas Day, everyone knows that about this time of the year geese are in their prime, and are particularly good when stuffed with sage, which accounts for the fact that Sithorpe has made some sage remarks, so that he may not lose by comparison with the foolish birds, with whom he feels a natural sympathy. We have never been able to discover the connection between geese and Michaelmas. There is a reason for associating ducks with midsummer. We can understand the meaning of poultry at Christmas, for birds are appropriate to a period when everyone sends in his bill, but why poor Saint Michael should be so degradingly associated with a goose is beyond our comprehension, and baffles our ingenuity. If Street Michael had been a tailor, or an actor, or an author, we could have understood how goose might have applied to him, but as he was neither one nor the other, we really are at a loss to conceive why a goose should have become so intimately associated with his name and character. Among other curious incidents, it may be remarked that, with an instinctive dread of goose, the redoubtable Martinuzzi drew in his horns, just on the eve of Michaelmas, and the syncretics had just shut up shop in time to avoid the compliments of the season that they had every right and every reason to anticipate would be bestowed. if not with a liberal hand, at least with a lavish mouth, by their audience. It must be remembered by all the geese against whom Punch thinks proper to indulge his wit, that at this season of the year they must expect to be roasted. Upon the whole, however, we had a high respect for the foolish bird, and when it is remembered that the geese saved Rome, we do not think we are wrong in suggesting the possibility of England being yet saved by Lord Coventry, or any other cackler in either House of Parliament. Land sharks and seagulls. Admiral Napier observed that retired lawyers got better paid than retired admirals. A gross injustice, as their vocations bear an extraordinary similarity. For example, both are attachés of the fleet, in an action. Both know the necessity of being bailed out to prevent swamping. One service is distinguished by its debits, the other by its affidavits, and they are mutually and equally admired for, and known by, their craft. The only difference between them being, that the lawyer serves two masters, the admiral, invariably, three masters. If the same remark applies to the members of the army list, as well as to those of the navy and law, we must say that it is an extremely shabby method of list of outrages. The following list of outrages, recently perpetrated in the vicinity of a notoriously bad house near Westminster Abbey, has not appeared in any of the daily papers. Lord Melbourne frightfully beaten, and turned out of his house by a gang of felites. Lord John Russell struck on the head by a large majority, and flung into a quandary. Lord Codenham tripped up by a well-known member of the swell mob, and robbed of his seals. Mr. Roebuck stripped and treated with barbarous inhumanity by a notorious bruiser named The Times. The unfortunate gentleman lies to the present moment speechless from the injuries he has sustained. Lord Enora Mayenby stabbed with some sharp instrument, supposed to be Lord Stanley's tongue. Lord Enora Ph struck in the dark by an original idea, from the effects of which he has not yet recovered. Root and branch, Roebuck, in complaining of the stigmas cast by The Times upon his pedigree, and vehemently insisting on the character of his family tree, was kindly assisted by Tom Duncombe, who declared the genus indisputable, as nobody could look in Roebuck's face without perceiving his family tree must have been the plane tree. Songs for the sentimental. Number 8. You say I have forgot the vow I breathed in days long past, but had I faithful been, that thou hadst loved me to the last, without me, eat on a throne wouldst scorn with me, contended beg, false maid, tease not that I'm forsworn, the boots on t'other leg, amidst the revel thou wast gay, the blithest with the song, though thou believed'st me far away, an exile act alone, 'twas then, and not till then, my heart to love thee did refuse, my vows became false that thou art, another pair of shoes, affairs in China, private letter from a young officer at the English factory, Canton, to his brother in England, dear Tom, everything is going on gloriously, the British arms are triumphant and we now only require the Emperor of China's consent to our taking possession of his territory, which I am sorry to say there is at present no likelihood of obtaining. However, there is little doubt, if we be not all swept off by ague and cholera, that we shall be able to maintain our present position a few months longer. Our situation here would be very comfortable if we had anything to eat, except bad beef and worse biscuit. These, however, are but trifling inconveniences, and though we had no fresh meat, we had plenty of fish in the river. One of our men caught a fine one the other day, which was bought and cooked for the officer's mess, by which means we were all nearly destroyed, the fish unfortunately happening to be of a poisonous nature, in consequence of which a general order was issued the next day, forbidding the troops to catch or eat any more fish. The country around the factory is beautiful, but we deem it prudent to keep within the walls, as the Chinese are very expert at picking up stragglers, whom they usually strangle. Beyond this we cannot complain of our situation. Fowls are extremely abundant, but I have not seen any, the inhabitants having carried them up the country along with their cattle and provisions of every description. The water here is so brackish that it is almost impossible to drink it. There are, however, some wells of delicious water in the neighborhood, which would be a real treasure to us if the Chinese had not poisoned them. Notwithstanding these unavoidable privations, the courage of our troops is indomitable. A detachment of the TH regiment succeeded last week in taking possession of an island in the river, nearly half an acre in extent. It has, however, since been deemed advisable to relinquish this important conquest, owing to the muddy nature of the soil, into which several of our brave fellows sank to the middle, and were with difficulty extricated. A gallant affair took place a few days ago between two English men of war's boats and a Chinese market junk, which was taken after a resolute defense on the part of the Chinaman and his wife, who kept up a vigorous fire of pumpkins and watermelons upon our boats, until their supply was exhausted, when they were forced to surrender to British valor. The captured junk has since been cut up for the use of the forces, though this unpleasant state of affairs has interrupted all formal intercourse between the Chinese and English. Captain Elliot has given a succession of balls to the occupants of a small mud fort near the shore, which I fear they did not relish, as several of them appeared exceedingly hurt, and removed with remarkable celerity out of reach of the captain's civilities. Thus, instead of opening the trade, this proceeding has only served to open the breach. The Emperor, I hear, is enraged at our successes, and has ordered the head and tail of the Mandarin, Cushing, to be sent in pickle to the Imperial Court at Pekin. A new Mandarin has arrived, who has presented a chop to Captain Elliot, but I hope, where there is so much at stake, that he will not be put off with a chop. There is no description of tea to be had in the market now but gunpowder, which, by the last reports, is going off briskly. Our amusements are not very numerous, being chiefly confined to yawning and sleeping. Of this latter recreation I must confess that we enjoy but little, owing to the mosquitoes, who are remarkably active and persevering in their attacks upon us. But with the exception of these tormenting insects, and a rather alarming variety of centipedes, scorpions, and spiders, we have no venomous creatures to disturb us. The weather is extremely hot, and the advantages of the river for bathing would be very great if it were not so full of sharks. I have much more to relate of our present cheering prospects and enviable situation, but the ship is on the point of sailing for England. So must conclude in haste. Ever, dear Tom, yours, R.B. Poachtigatism. The Examiner observes, in speaking of the types of the new premier's policy, the state, I and the state, said the most arrogant of French monarchs, the administration, I and the administration, would seem to say Sir Robert Peel, in the speech explanatory of his views, which cannot be likened to a Wolsey's ego et rex muse, because the importance of the ego is not impaired by any addition. This literally amounts to a conviction, on the part of the editor of the Examiner, that the Premier's expression is all in his eye. The Political Naturalist's library contents of the volumes already published, The Supernatural History of Humming Birds, with memoir and portraits of Peel, Stanley and Aberdeen, Birds of the Game Kind, Portrait and Memoir of Mr. Gully, Fishes of the Perch Genus, Biographical Notices of the Late Ministry, Ruminating Animals, Volume 1, Contents, Goats, and C. Portrait of Mr. Munts, Ruminating Animals, Volume 2, Contents, Deer, Antelopes, and C. Portrait of Mr. Roebuck, Marsupials, O.R., Pouched Animals, with Many Plates, Portrait and Memoir of Daniel O'Connell, Esquire, British Butterflies, Portrait and Memoir of Sir Elton Bulwer. Completion of the work. Considerable progress has been making in the concluding volume of the series, Rats, with portraits of Burdett, Gibson, Walkley, and Gina Somme, but the subject is so vast that no definite time can be fixed for its publication. A great card. Mr. W. A. Cayley begs to inform the Lords of the Treasury, the editor of the Times, and the Master of the Mint, that ever anxious to arise in the world, he has recently been induced to undertake the sweeping of conservative flues, and the performance of any dirty work which his Tory patrons may deem him worthy to perform. Certain objections having been made as to his qualifications for a climbing boy, Mr. W. pledges himself to undergo any course of training, to enable him to get through the business, and to remove any apprehension of his ever becoming the poetical justice. Sir Peter Lorre, in commenting upon the late case of false imprisonment, where two young men had been unjustifiably handcuffed by the police, delivered himself of the following exquisite piece of rhetoric. He did not think it possible that such a case of abuse could pass unnoticed as that he had just heard. The general conduct of the police was, he believed, good, but the instances of arbitrary conduct and overbearing demeanor set to flight all the ancient examples brought forward to enrich by contrast the serious parts of the glorious genius of Shakespeare. We never understood or imagined there was an Anacreon among the aldermen, a Chaucer in the Common Council, or a Moliere at the Mansion House. We have now discovered the Peter Laureate of the city, the poet of the poultry, who, in the face of the above sentence, can deny his right to these titles, if, like ourselves, they are the evil most to be dreaded. a clergyman, lately preaching to a country congregation, used the following persuasive arguments against the vice of swearing:
"Oh, my brethren, avoid this practice, for it is a great sin, and, what is more, it is ungenteel. Punch's Theater. What will the world say? The family of the Sponges distributes itself over the entire face of society. Its members are familiar with almost every knocker, and with nearly everybody's dinner hour. They not infrequently come in with the eggs, and only go out with the last glass of negus. They seem to possess the power of ubiquity, for, go where you will, your own especial Sponge and everybody with more than 200 a year has one, is sure to present himself. He is ready for anything, especially where eating, love, dueling, or drinking, is concerned. To oblige you, he will breakfast at supper time, or sup at breakfast time. He will drink any given quantity, at any time, and will carry any number of declarations of love to any number of ladies, or of challenges to whole armies of rivals. Thus far he is full, for he is obliging, and will do anything but they. When he has absorbed all the moisture his victims are able to supply, he may be seen walking about in moody solitude in the parks, where he sponges upon the ducks, and owes for the use of the chairs, in this dry and destitute condition. Behold the Sponge of the Covent Garden Comedy, Captain Turtle. He is in St. James Park, for, possessing imaginary rather than substantial claims to military rank, he flits about the horse guards to keep up his character. A person is already upon the stage, for whom you instinctively shudder. You perceive, at once, that he is in for dinner, wine, theater, and supper. You pity him. You see the Sponge, speciously, but surely, fasten himself upon his victim like a vampire. Mr. Pillory, being a barrister and a man of the world, resigns himself, however, to his fate, as to shaking off his leech. He knows that to be impossible, and he determines to make what use of him he can. There is a fine opportunity, for Mr. Pillory is in love, in despair, and in waiting. He expects his mistress's Abigail, in negotiating with whom he conceives Turtle will be a valuable assistant. Mrs. Tattle arrives, preliminaries having been duly settled, articles offensive and defensive are entered into, to carry out a plan by which the lover shall gain an interview with the mistress, and the treaty is ratified by a liberal donation, which the captain makes to the maid out of his friend's purse. The servant is satisfied, and goes off in the utmost agitation, for Miss Maylie and her guardian are coming, and she dreads being caught in the fact of bribery. Mr. Hillary trembles, so does the young lady, when she appears, and the agitation of all parties is only put an end to by the fall of the act drop. If any class of Her Majesty's subjects are more miserable than another, it is that of gentlemen's servants. One of these oppressed persons is revealed to us in the next act. Poor fellow, he has nothing to do but to sit in the hall, and nothing to amuse him but the newspaper. But his misfortunes do not end here. As if to add insult to injury, the family governess presumes to upbraid him, and actually insists upon his taking a letter to the post. Mr. Nibble declines performing so undignified a service, in the most footman-like terms, but unfortunately, as it generally happens, in families where there are pretty governesses and gallant sons, Miss Tvere has a protector in the Hon. Charles Norwold, who overhears her unreasonable demand, and with a degree of injustice enough to make the entire livery of London rave with indignation, inflicts upon his father's especial livery, and Nibble's illustrious person, a severe caning. The consequence of this strike island that Nibble gives warning, Lord and Lady Norwold are paralyzed at this important resignation, for by it they discover that a secret coalition has taken place between their son and the governess. They are man and wife. Good heavens, the heir of all the Norwolds marry a teacher, who has nothing to recommend her but virtue, talent, and beauty. Monstrous. What will the world say? The treaty formed between Mistress Tat and Mr. Pillory is in the next act being acted upon. We behold Captain Turtle, as one of the high contracting party's ambassador, taking lodgings in a house exactly opposite to that in which Miss Maylie resides. Of course nothing so natural as that the captain should indulge his friend with a visit for a few days, or, if possible, for a few weeks. It is also natural that the host, under the circumstances, should wish to know something of the birth, parentage, and education of his guest, of which, though an old acquaintance, the island as yet, entirely ignorant. Now, if it be possible to affront a real Sponge, but there is nothing more difficult, such inquiries are likely to produce that happy consummation. Turtle, however, gets over the difficulty with the tact peculiar to his class, and is fortunately interrupted by the announcement that Tattle is in the parlor, duly keeping her agreement, by bringing her mistress's favorite canary, which, having flown away quite by accident, under her guidance, has chosen to perch in Hillary's new lodging, on purpose to give him the opportunity of returning it, and of obtaining an interview with Miss Maylie. The expedient succeeds in the next scene. The lover bows and stammers as lovers do at first interviews. The lady is polite but dignified, and Turtle, who has been angling for an invitation, has his hopes entirely put to flight by the entrance of the lady's guardian, Mr. Warner, who very promptly cuts matters short by ringing the bell and saying, "Good evening," in that tone of voice which always intimates a desire for a good riddance. This hint is too broad ever to be mistaken, so the sponge and his victim back out. Mr. Warner is a merchant, and all merchants in plays are the noblest characters the world can boast, and very rich. Thus it has happened that Warner has, through a money agent, one Grub, been enabled to lend, at various times, large sums of money, to a Lady Norwold, her ladyship being one of those who, dreading what will the world say, is by no means an economist, and prefers ruin to a retrenchment. As security for these loans, the lady deposits her jewels, sweet by sweet, till the great object of all Warner's advances gets into his possession, namely, a bracelet, which is a revered relic of the Norwold family. So far Warner, in spite of a troublesome ward, and his late visitors, is happy, but he soon receives a letter, which puts his happiness to flight. His daughter, who has been on a visit in Paris, became, he now learns, united some months before, to Charles Norwold, and a governess in his father's family. By further inquiries, he learns that the son is discarded, and island with his wife, consigned to beggary, for fear of, what will the world say. The fourth act exhibits one of the scenes of human life hitherto veiled from the eyes of the most prying of genuine specimen of the sponge species at home, actually living under a roof that he calls his own, in company with a wife who is certainly nobody else. She is ironing, turtedly smoking, and, like all smokers, philosophizing. Here we learn the Honorable Charles Norwold and his wife have taken lodgings. Hither they are pursued by Hillary, who has managed to ingratiate himself with Warner, and undertaken to trace the merchant's lost daughter. Here, to Pye's astonishment, he finds his friend and sponge. Some banter ensues, not always agreeable to the captain, but all ends very pleasantly by the entrance of Warner, who discovers his daughter, and becomes a father-in-law with a good grace. The denouement is soon told. Warner, having received his daughter and her husband, gives a party at which Lady, and afterwards Lord Norwold, are present. Here Warner's anxiety to obtain the bracelet is explained. He reminds his lordship that he once accused his elder brother of stealing that very bauble, and the consequence was, that the accused disappeared, and was never after heard of. Warner avows himself to be that brother, but declines disturbing the rights or property of his lordship, if he will again receive his son. This island, of course, done. Hillary jokes himself into Miss Maylie's good graces, and Turtle, in all the glories of a brown coat, and an outrageously fine waistcoat, enters to make the scene complete, and to help to speak the tag, in which all the characters had a hand. Mrs. Glover ending by making a propitiatory appeal to the audience in favor of the author, who ought to be very grateful to her for the captivating tones in which she asked for an affirmative answer to the question, "What will the world say?" Circumstances prevent us from giving any opinion whatever, except upon the scenery, the appointments, and the acting. The first is beautiful, the second appropriate and splendid, the last natural, plant, and in good taste. SIBDHORPIANA. A clergyman was explaining to the gallant officer the meaning of the phrase, "born again," but it was quite unintelligible to Sid, who remarked that he knew no one who could bear him even once. "Do you read the notice to correspondence in Punch?" quoth Sid. "I do," replied Hardinge, "and I wonder people should send them such trash." "Pooh," retorted the punster, "pooh, you know that wherever Punch is to be found, there are always plenty of spoons after it. It's a wonder you're not drunk," said Sithorpe to a Wheeland, "a great wonder. Because do you give it up? Because you're a tumbler full of spirits." Curious ambiguity. The correspondent of a London paper, writing from Sunderland respecting the report that Lord Hawick had been fired at by some ruffian, says, with great naivete, A gun was certainly pointed at his lordship's head, but it is generally believed there was nothing in it. We confess we are at a loss to know whether the facetious writer alludes to the gun or the head. The Thorny Premier, a Tory evening paper, tells its readers that Sir Robert Peel expects a harassing opposition from the late ministry, but that he is prepared for them on all points. This reminds us of the defensive expedient of the hedgehog, which, conscious of its weakness, rolls itself into a ball, to be prepared for its assailants on all points. To professors of languages who give long credit and take small pay, Mr. F. N.C. Bailey is anxious to treat for a course of lessons in the purest Irish. None but such as will conceal a West Indian patois will be of the slightest use. For particulars, and cards to view, apply to Mr. Cadmuck, Music and Marble Warehouse, 7 Dials, Punch, O.R. The London Charivari, Volume 1, for the week ending October 9, 1841, a manual of denouements, in the King's name, let fall your swords and daggers. Critic, a melodrama is a theatrical dose in 2 or 3 acts, according to the strength of the constitution of the audience. Its component parts are a villain, a lover, a heroine, a comic character, and an executioner. These having simmered and macerated through all manner of events, are strained off together into the last scene, and the effervescence which then ensues is called the denouement, and the denouement is the soul of the drama. Denouements are of 3 kinds, the natural, the unnatural, and the supernatural. The natural is achieved when no probabilities are violated, that island when the circumstances are such as really might occur if we could only bring ourselves to think so. As example, Gr. When the villain, being especially desirous to preserve and secrete certain documents of vital importance to himself and to the peace, does, most unaccountably, mislay them in the most conspicuous part of the stage, and straightway they are found by the very last member of the dram, purse, in whose hands he would like to see them. When the villain and his accomplice, congratulating each other on the successful issue of their crimes, and dividing the spoil thereof, which they are always careful to do in a loud voice, and in a room full of closets, are suddenly set upon and secured by the innocent yet suspected and condemned parties, who are at that moment passing on their way to execution. When the guiltless prisoner at the bar, being asked for his defense, and having no witnesses to call, produces a checked handkerchief, and subpoenas his own conscience, which has such an effect on the villain, that he swoons, and sees demons in the jury box, and tells them that he is ready, and that he comes, and see, when the deserter, being just about to be shot, is miraculously saved by his mistress, who cuts the matter very fine indeed, by rushing in between present and fire, and, having ejaculated a reprieve, with all her might, falls down, overcome by fatigue, poor dear, as well she may, having run 23 miles in the changing of a scene, and carried her baby on her arm all the blessed way, in order to hold him up in the tableau at the end. Envy whenever married people rescue one another as above. The denouement belongs to the class, and natural, which is used when the author wishes to show the intensity of his invention. As example, Gr. Again, when an old man, having been wounded fatally by a young man, requests, as a boon, to be permitted to examine the young man's neck, who, accordingly unloosing his cravat, displays a hieroglyphic neatly engraved thereon, which the old man interprets into his being a parricide, and then dies, leaving the young man in a state of histrionic stupor. When a will is found embellished with a daguerreotype of 4 fingers and a thumb, done in blood on the cover, and it turns out that the residuary legatee is no better than he should be, but, on the contrary, a murderer nicely ripe for killing, the supernatural denouement is the last resource of a bewildered dramatist, and introduces either an individual in green scales and wings to match, who gives the audience to understand that he is a fiend, and that he has private business to transact below with the villain, who, accordingly, withdraws in his company, with many throes and groans, down the trap, or a pale ghost in dingy lawn, apparently afflicted with a serious hemorrhage in the bosom, who appears to a great many people, running, in dreams, and at last joins the hands of the young couple, and puts in a little plea of her own for a private burial. And there are many other variations of the 3 great classes of denouements, such as the helter-skelter 9 times round the stage combat, and the grand melee in which everybody kills everybody else, and leaves the piece to be carried on by their executors, but we dare unveil the mystery no further.